And you are listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org. This is In Context.
Hi, everybody. Happy Monday afternoon, despite the rain. I hope you're enjoying your day.
Yay, Monday!
you are listening to 89.5 WPKN FM. This is In Context, WPKN's weekly public affairs call-in program. And last week, we discussed problems facing the U.S., the declining middle class, polarization of incomes, attacks on our civil liberties. And today we're going to be talking specifically about solutions and ideas that we have about ways to reverse the decline of America. And we are going to open the phones later on in the hour to hear all of your ideas and your feedback on our ideas, because last week one of the big recurring themes, it seemed, in the phone calls was, all right, yeah, we know what's wrong. How do we fix it? So today we decided we're just going to come in with a really long list of ideas on how to fix things and try to elicit your feedback. And if you want to find us online, our website is incontextreport.com. And you can find us on YouTube by going to youtube.com/incontextreport. And you can also like us on Facebook by searching In Context Report.
Okay, that was Gus Canavero.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I'm new at these introductions here. I'm Gus Canavero.
And this is Ken McDermott Rowe. We're your In Context host. And behind the board is Marchand McDermott Rowe, who is also our military affairs commentator. As Gus said, in our last show, we had a pretty thorough discussion of what's wrong with the country, the middle class in decline, the economy stagnating, and our civil liberties under assault. And a several callers said, yeah, what can we do about it? So Gus and I have worked up several specific solutions, which kind of amount to, I think, a platform for a new political party. So the way we'd like to set up the show is I'm going to take some foreign affairs, national security issues, talk about them for maybe 5 to 10 minutes, and then Gus will do similarly with the domestic issues, and then we'll open the phones, and we'd like to get your input, your comments on our suggestions, and your own ideas about how we can improve the country. So let's start and quickly review some interesting suggestions for what we should do in foreign policy. And what we really need, I think, both domestic and foreign policy in this country is a peaceful revolution. We need a second party in this country. We've got one party, one monster with two heads, as Ralph Nader calls it, or in the words of the great Senator Huey Long, the difference between the Democrats and Republicans is that one skins you from the neck down and the other skins you from the ankles up.
I can find that clip if you want me to.
Okay. Maybe you can look for that one. It's on YouTube. So to start with, let's look at the foreign policy, national security issues. First, the real no-brainer is we end the foreign wars. We bring our troops home. We've got troops in like 130 countries. We have over 700 foreign military bases. We need to return to a foreign policy of non-intervention that served us so well, really throughout the early years of our republic, up until 1898 when we started the Spanish-American War. It will save us hundreds of billions of dollars. It will improve our relationship with foreign countries who will no longer see the United States as attempting to have world military hegemony. And we can focus on improved relations and on expanding trade with foreign countries. Avoid entangling alliances. That's what George Washington and Thomas Jefferson said. And that's the policy we should return to. It is associated with that. We should restore our Constitution when it comes to war making. No more the president running off and committing U.S. troops here hither and yon. It's got to be approved by Congress, which has the only power, only institution vested with the power to declare war. And it is also the institution with the sole power to initiate spending. Our Congress could cut off these wars anytime just by refusing to spend the money. Another issue, associated policy change is we need a new military policy. Our military policy is now based on fighting wars all over the world, and we've neglected our home defenses. Isn't that the policy? The purpose of our military is to defend the United States. So we should bring these troops home, and we should start looking at deficiencies in our current defenses.
And I think on that note, one thing people need to realize is that when we have 500,000 American soldiers overseas, that means we have 500,000 less to defend the homeland, 500,000 less to watch the borders, 500,000 to prevent a foreign country from invading us.
And in terms of a new military policy, Marchand has done a YouTube video on the emphasis on the importance on rebuilding our coastal defenses and to anticipate submarine warfare, which is really where our great vulnerability is. If you could just talk just for 1 second about that, Marchand.
Oh, absolutely. Traditionally, what we as the United States always saw as our greatest defense was our coastline. The fact that we have these long stretches of coastline, giant oceans separate us from our enemies. Well, that was true up until probably near the end of the Cold War, when the Chinese and the Russians started developing submarines that can carry not just aircraft, not just ballistic missiles, but division, battalion and brigade and division even size military elements. They could land Marines on either of our coastlines and or launch missiles on our coastlines. We'd have about 30 seconds of warning before there were Chinese troops in New York City or Russian troops for that matter, or before missiles started landing on the continental U.S.
In fact, the Chinese and the Russians are now patrolling the American coast with their advanced submarines, right?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the reasons. And, you know, folks, you can go and look this up and fact check it. But there was a very impressive article that stated the Russians have built a naval base in Venezuela. Now, the significance of that is that traditionally the Russian ships had to sail from their Baltic port in near St. Petersburg, sail them across the Atlantic, patrol our coast, and then go all the way back, which meant they couldn't be constantly on our coast. But now, because of Venezuela, they can send ships there, dock, refuel, resupply, and then go up and down our coast, refuel, resupply, and keep submarines a constant presence. And we really have no sonar nets anymore, so to speak of. We have no coastal defenses. So, I mean, it's
child's play. Sonar net was our way of alerting ourselves that enemy vessels are getting too close.
Exactly. That was how during the Cold War we kept the Russians off our coast.
And but how much warning would we have if there was a submarine attack from an enemy submarine shooting missiles at a
city? About 30 seconds. And that is no exaggeration. We would have about 30 seconds.
So while we're trying to win the hearts and minds of people in Afghanistan who do not want us there,
yeah,
right?
In
vulnerable to an attack in 30 seconds notice from the Russians or the Chinese.
Exactly. And the American people have to realize this is not Al-Qaeda is not the imminent threat. The Russians and the Chinese, who are the new growing imperial powers, are.
And you know what? If we close those 130 bases and we bring back those 700 military installations and bring the troops home, people aren't going to have the reason to attack us either. We will have much better relationships with foreign countries.
If we develop an America first policy, national defense first, bring the troops home, protect our borders, build coastal defenses, set up Patriot missile systems, we can turn this into Fortress America, make ourselves impregnable, then no one would dare attack us. Then we can have better relations because people won't view us as a threat, and we won't have to view our neighbors as a threat either.
And a couple more planks in the platform. Abolish the Selective Service. We need a draft in this country like we need a hole in the head. The draft is slavery. And I think we have a caller now.
Yeah, we actually do. 1 second.
We haven't even announced the phone number.
Yeah, very good memory out there.
Okay.
You know, and it's also interesting with the submarine issue, because if you think about how easy it is for drug smugglers, the drug cartels, to smuggle drugs into this country by using submersible vehicles, they have these faux submarines. Have you seen those?
Yeah.
Where only the... there's just a window above water, and the rest of it is below the water.
I see.
They're like not real submarines, you know,
yes.
But they are submersible. And the Coast Guard has a very difficult time locating these vehicles, and they just drive right up to the docks. They pull up on the beach, they offload the drugs, back in the water they go, and then they go back to Mexico.
Do we have a caller there, Marchand?
Hang on, I'm multitasking.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, I got this. This is Stephen from Bridgeport. Go ahead, Stephen. You're on the air with the
BPN. You're on the air, Stephen.
Yeah, you made a mention about the Atlantic Soyuz net no longer being functional. I find that pretty hard to believe that our Atlantic deep water surveillance radar net that's been functioning, you know, since the late 70s is no longer viable. We know everything that goes on the Atlantic.
Okay.
Well,
I mean, we've known everything that goes on the Atlantic. I mean, it's...
Thank you
very much for the call. We don't want to get too sidetracked
here.
Thanks very much.
Go ahead.
But, well, to address your question, the sonar nets are still there. The problem that we have is that they're not being maintained, because we are investing so much of our defense budgets in everything from building bridges in Afghanistan and sewage treatment plants and, you know, and to buying new jets, investing in these drones. I mean, we gave Northrop Grumman, $350 billion for a aircraft carrier-based drone. So all this money is going to other projects, not the sonar nets. And a lot of that stems from the fact that our military doctrine right now, a friend of mine who was a Vietnam veteran once told me that America's always prepared to fight the last war. And that's the case. We're prepared right now to fight an insurgency, a colonial-style insurgency, but we're not maintaining the sonar nets. They're there, but there are a lot of holes, and that's how the Russians are coming up and down our coast.
I just want to finish up on the foreign policy and national security side before Gus takes on the domestic issues. Finally, and really importantly, we need to abolish the national security state. We should repeal the National Security Act of 1947 and the CIA and the NSA. Get rid of the Patriot Act. Get rid of this military detention provision in the National Defense Authorization Act. Get rid of the FISA courts, the military tribunals, the whole thing, that whole tendency to turn America into a police state. We should get rid of it, and we should return our liberties to our people.
Right.
So now why don't we go ahead and look at the domestic side, and then we'll take some phone calls after we – some more phone calls.
Well, it's interesting. Both these issues are completely integrated. They're very – they're intertwined with each other because, you know, as the old quote, war is the health of the state goes, the federal government doesn't have its authority without an outward threat at all times. So things like
the 1984.
Yeah, well, things like FISA and the CIA coexist with each other because they need each other. They need to keep that illegal court going in order to justify itself. You know, if they can't prosecute people and drain the society of all of its funding in order to keep itself going, you know, it has to keep it going. And that's why we have things like the drug wars. And so one of the first things I would do is end the war on drugs. We have an uphill, unwinnable battle that stems from prohibition, and where we made alcohol, marijuana, and all kinds of harmless and harmful drugs illegal. But they were all legal before prohibition, and we didn't have rampant drug use drunkenness going on. Instead, it became this religious zealotry where they were going to try to purify the American people somehow and make us all these moral, upstanding individuals. Before, you could buy cocaine if you wanted it, but you know, you were just basically looked down on, down upon. But you could buy it and use it if you wanted to, if you were dumb enough, and go ahead and abuse yourself. But it didn't make us any less profitable or any less lawful of a society. But as soon as we had prohibition, we now had billions of dollars being poured into this endless pursuit of people who were just having a casual alcoholic beverage after work. Now, all of a sudden, everything was illegal, and it became the morality police in the United States running around. And what it did was it created black markets. So crime went up astronomically. Now, all of a sudden, we have rum running of low-quality, dangerous alcohol that was causing blindness in people, and drunkenness became an epidemic instead. Now, all of a sudden, people wanted something because it was illegal. After prohibition was repealed by FDR, they repealed the prohibition of alcohol, but not on things like hemp, which doesn't even have THC in it. And the reason why that they didn't repeal hemp was because it was in competition with synthetic materials like polyester and rayon and other things like that. So the cotton industry, polyester, which I think was created by Dow Chemicals, which is a major corporation in American history, used their lobbying power to be able to keep hemp illegal. Now, hemp is not only nutritious for a source of protein, it's a really healthy vegetarian source of fat and omega fatty acids, which would go a long way to eliminating depression in our society, eliminating the needs for drugs and things like that. It has a lot of healing properties. And better yet, you can use it to create clothing. It makes paper that lasts 80 times longer than wood pulp paper, so we wouldn't have to grow acres and acres of wood trees just to cut them down and turn them into paper that just gets recycled later on or thrown out. Hemp is a reusable weed, and it makes much more stronger materials than the wood pulp alternative. You can make housing materials out of hemp. You can make shoes, roofing tiles. You can make many millions of products out of hemp. And it's illegal to grow domestically. So if we open up the ability for domestically grown hemp to be grown here, because right now the only hemp you can buy is imported. All right. So why is it that we have an embargo on domestically grown product, but you can buy it if it's imported? That makes absolutely no sense, and it drives up the price of something that's not only useful but nutritious.
Well, and you know, if especially on the subject of domestic drugs, if I can ask you this, if drugs were legalized, just the same as alcohol is legalized, don't you think that one of the reasons why we would see drug abuse would be the same reason why we see alcohol abuse, a social problem versus the fact that it's just available?
I mean, but it's still a personal liberty issue, you know, and why, what causes abuse, I think, is probably personal depression or just lack of responsibility.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, it's not really the availability that causes the overuse of it. You know, that's like saying the going back to that stupid birth control issue of the Republican debates where Santorum basically alluded to the availability of birth control leads to inhibitions of people, you know, bad behavior.
Yeah, because
maybe one of the reasons why people tend to be attracted to drugs is because the economy is so bad, because there's so few opportunities.
Yeah.
And that was one of the themes of our last show. What kind of policies do you think could we put in place to create more good paying job opportunities in the United States?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of ideas, and farming, I think, is a staple of society. And that's why I mentioned hemp. And I think that we need to invest in farming technology, tools, and allow small farms to prosper, because they really are a backbone of society. Locally grown, readily available food by local farms is a staple because it employs local individuals, it buys tools locally, it feeds the community, and you know where the food comes from, and it's much more nutritious than coming from a factory farm someplace where you have no idea of the origin or the way those animals are treated or anything like that. So I think that eliminating a lot of red tape for small farms and getting rid of the power of the big farming industry lobby would go a long way. And Ron Paul's platform of eliminating the power of lobbies by eliminating the lobby's ability to buy influence in government vis-a-vis the government's ability to impose red tape, it's all a domino effect. If you get rid of Congress's ability to hamstring small businesses, then the lobbies no longer have a reason to buy lobbying influence.
And the farm suggestion really ties into two other important domestic issues. One is reducing this $1.5 trillion chronic deficit we have, and the other is to decentralize America politically and economically.
Right, and it would bring down the cost of locally grown organic food, because now all of a sudden they can expand. They no longer have to pay for the really expensive like animal ID testing. Big businesses are exempt from almost all of the legislation that they produce. Like Tyson has to only pay for testing of a few chickens in their warehouse of a million chickens, whereas a small farmer, because they're not set up the same way, has to test each chicken individually and prove that they're healthy. You know, so it's much more expensive for a small farm to exist than it is for a large farm based on the same benchmark.
And the food issue also connects to
the health care issue,
because
exactly.
Right now, folks, we spend almost a fifth of the gross domestic product of the United States in health care. It's almost double what our European
competitors
spend. And
it's because we're eating nutritionally dead food. We are not eating food that is coming from healthy soil. Instead, it's uncrop rotated soil where the soil is depleted of the nutrition that's needed. Instead, they just throw the super fertilizer chemical onto the plants just to get them to come to bloom, and then they pick it before it's ripe, and they ship it 3/4 of the way across the country, and then they spray it with a chemical so it ripens.
And, you know, I think all of this also connects into the national security issue as well, because if you have more nutritious food, you're breeding better people.
Exactly.
And people that are physically healthier, physically stronger,
yeah.
You know, and then additionally to that, we are making ourselves self-sufficient and independent. This means that if, you know, the IMF or any of those international organizations, the United Nations, I don't trust any international organizations, as far
right.
as I could throw them, they decide, you know what, United States, we don't like you for whatever reason. We don't like what you're doing. You know what? We're putting sanctions on you. I mean, look at what happened to other nations where they get sanctions thrown on them. People starved to death.
Yeah.
This would allow us to be self-sufficient. We could literally say to the rest of the world, we don't need you. We
right.
could survive on our own.
So you're going to switch this whole huge medical industry more towards nutrition,
right.
towards healthy living, away from this crazy
right.
prescription drug madness.
Mm-hmm.
It's changing a paradigm. It's really a cultural change, isn't it? Small farming, cooking with growing food without pesticides, healthy mm-hmm. living, and also I think there's a social, an important social component that relates to healthcare. We need to move more towards a home-based healthcare, I think, where you take care of yourself. Right now, to put one elderly person in a nursing home in Connecticut runs about $140,000 a mm-hmm. year. Right? That's unsustainable.
Completely unsustainable.
We spend more than 17% of our GDP on healthcare, and the Medicaid, Medicare portion of our budget is now close to $1 trillion. I think it's about $800 billion. There's no way we can have a national healthcare system in this country if we continue to practice medicine and have a healthcare system the kind that we have now.
Exactly. And another thing that we could do, I think, is sort of connecting with the foreign aid issue. I think we need to end foreign aid, but mostly because the foreign aid that we send to other countries is used for weapons. So we're exporting weapons of destruction. That's the only thing that the United States exports is elements of destruction and manipulation. So instead, if you're hung up on foreign aid out there and you think that that's heartless, why don't we change the foreign aid from dollars for bombs to dollars for tractors so that countries in Africa are able to farm for themselves and feed themselves instead of having to buy our unwanted canned goods, you know, so that we send them over there so that they're fed today, but they're hungry tomorrow. If we teach them how to irrigate, how to farm, and we send them some tractors that they buy that are American made, like Cat or, you know, Caterpillar or something else, Mack truck. You know, we can send them a few billion dollars of aid if they buy some domestically made trucks. That's basically the only way I allow foreign aid, because foreign aid is basically unconstitutional.
And you think about that. That's all part of, you know, making friends instead of enemies. I mean, you know,
right.
when we send money to Israel and they use it to drop white phosphorus on Palestinians, and everybody else in the rest of the world, because obviously it doesn't appear on our news, but everybody else in the rest of the world sees Palestinian children with missing jaws, missing legs, you know, yeah. been burned to death. I don't know if anybody in our audience has ever seen anyone burned by white phosphorus, but it's horrific beyond all belief. People see that, and then they say, this is what America stands for?
Yeah.
And,
you
this
know,
is what the American freedom
and
is?
And as we talk about foreign policy, healthcare policy, foreign policy, whatever, it all reflect the dominance of our government by large corporations.
And special interest
groups. One of the changes that I would strongly support is an end to the notion of corporate personhood. It's an insane legal theory came into being around the turn of the century. It said a corporation should be endowed with all the constitutional protections of an individual. It was nuts, and it's one of the key things that allows corporations to influence our legislators. They supposedly have free speech. Corporations with free speech, it's nuts. We should get rid of the whole notion of corporate personhood and take away their special status in society.
And then continuing on with the small business ideas, we need to end the regulations that favor the big businesses, as I said. But we have the Small Business Administration, SBA, which is a government administration, which as all government administrations, is a complete joke. And the League of Small Business out there, their spokesman is Lloyd Chapman. You can look him up. He's a very outspoken individual, really, really well researched. And he has a report out that says that 72 out of the top 100 recipients of small business contracts from the federal government in 2011 were actually large corporations. And how they get around that is by they create shell companies that are smaller than 100 employees, and then they get the big contract.
But
that money just filters right back up to the main umbrella company.
That's great.
So it's fraud on top of fraud on top of fraud. And again, a lot of those corporations are foreign-owned corporations. So we have Spanish companies that create a shell corporation in the United States, our subsidiary. They get the job, which they send the money right back to Spain. All right, so the government that we have is one gigantic fraud that creates agencies to make people think that they're standing up for us when in reality they're just bilking you. So, again, we have to reduce red tape for small businesses, simplify the tax code, get rid of government subsidies because it never goes to who you want it to go to. eliminate subsidies for ethanol. All right. That's a technology that's not going anywhere. It was originally sold by George Bush, and it said that it would be a better carbon footprint, but it turns out that it costs more energy
to
create the ethanol than it does to create gasoline. And what are you doing with, how are you creating it? You're using corn. You're growing acres and acres of corn.
So now you're competing with the food market.
Exactly. Now the cost of corn goes up. The cost of feed for meat goes up. Now your meat is more expensive. These are all the nuances of society. We wonder why we're spending so much more money now than we were 50 years ago on basic necessities, and why our cost of living going up and our quality of life is going down. It's all of these little chain reactions that we don't even realize happen.
Gus, why don't I give out the phone number as we continue our discussion? Because we very much would like your input, listeners. If you just joined us, the name of the show is In Context. It's WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. In our last show, we talked a lot about the serious economic and civil rights problems facing the Americans today. In today's show, we're laying out a lot of specific solutions that listeners ask us, well, what can we do about it? We're laying out specific solutions. Essentially, it's a possible platform for a new party. And if you'd like to call in with your comments or any suggestions you may have, give us a ring at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or you could drop us an email if you prefer not to speak on the air at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. And we have our laptops open, so we'll get your email as soon as you send it. Do we have a call already?
Yes, this is Bill from Easton. Go ahead, Bill. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Folks said there were 740 military bases around the globe. I thought it was 840.
Oh, I didn't mention a specific number. Chalmers Johnson says in his series on the declining of the American empire, over 700. So
but some of those are black sites, and depends what you're counting.
But would you have a comment or a question, caller?
And here's something that says that according to the 2010 Department of Defense base structure report, the U.S. military owns 172,015 buildings inside the U.S. with a total size of over 1.5 billion square feet. It owns another 202,178 in other countries, covering over 1.7 billion square feet. So if you want to know where the money goes, that's it. But some of it's a jobs program, so that's why it's not so easy to get rid of. Not that I believe that we shouldn't try really hard to get rid of all of that, because I don't know what we're getting as a return on an investment, mm-hmm. except, the false sense of security. I mean, you guys talk about worrying about some other foreign nation landing submarines and people springing out of them and taking over. I think that, one, that's fighting the last century's war, A, and B, what are you taking over but a country full of people whose education level seems to decline by the day, $15 trillion in debt. What are you coming here to steal?
Marshawn, maybe you have some thoughts on Bill's.
But let me say one more thing.
We have to move on after that. Go ahead.
That's okay. Your sense of what is a threat fails to note that the most difficult thing to secure won't be our physical borders, but it's all of the networked electronics which, enables everybody to watch everybody else. And you see that there was a report that the Iranian internet had been, attacked, or certain, oil production sites. And so what's really important? What sort of future do you want? Do you want to base it on
these are really good questions,
war?
Bill. We should really need to rethink our whole military strategy. Thank you so much for the call, Bill.
Thank you very much. And actually, I think you do raise a very good point. In terms of the cyber threat, that is definitely
we don't want to spend too much time in this.
That is definitely a huge threat. I don't want to understate that at all. I mean, the fact is, the Chinese brought down one of our drones in Iran by interfering with its GPS. But in terms of fighting the last century's war,
those are the Russians who actually helped the Iranians.
The Russians, sorry. But in terms of fighting the last century's war, how many times in human history, especially when you look at after the First World War, they said it was the Great War. There can never be another war like this. With each advent of technology, war has stayed the same for the last 100,000 years of human existence. I don't see any reason why it would change. And we have what the Chinese need, land. The Chinese need land. They're overpopulated. We have natural resources. And the fact is that the Chinese are not above exterminating 50% of the population of countries they invade. I mean, look at what they did to Tibet, for heaven's sake.
It's the way they do things.
It's the way they do things.
It's their M.O.
It's their M.O. In Korea, Chinese death squads executed American prisoners. I actually just saw a great documentary on the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir. You know, they just executed
Marshawn, if we adopt a policy of non-interference...
The one problem here is that he mentioned landing people on the shore. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about getting close enough to drop a nuke on the White House within 30 seconds.
Or an EMP that would
disable our entire eastern seaboard's electronic system. So this is not something basic like last century's war of dropping landing crafts of a couple hundred guys. That's not what we're talking about. This is a mass slaughter with a thermonuclear weapon or an EMP that would disable the eastern half of the United States.
But if we change our foreign policy fundamentally, which since the end of the Cold War has been towards global military hegemony, and specifically it's designed to cut our rising rival China off from sources of oil. That's what our wars all around the world are all primarily about. If we change our foreign policy and we say, hey, look, we're not going to interfere anymore, then the level of tension with the Chinese and the Russians will drop tremendously.
Right. That's exactly it. You know, scale down the tension, the standoff. I mean, why was Switzerland not invaded during World War II? You look at the map, everything around it was invaded. Now, partially they were holding gold for the Germans, but they were also impenetrable. Every person in the country had a gun and it was surrounded by mountains. All right, it was impossible to invade.
And the Swiss have a very interesting concept, which is something I think we should consider adopting, is they have national conscription for a short period of time, but what you do is it's so that you learn how to fire a gun, and then you go home with your weapon and with all your military equipment. You keep it because the idea is that in the event of war, every citizen can take up an arm. And that's why Switzerland's never been invaded.
Yeah, and they've never had to invade anyone else, and they just fine the way they are. They have a non-intervention policy, which is what we were founded on. We were founded on the Swiss model. That's why we have the Second Amendment, because of the Swiss. We have the Second Amendment so that every person is part of the militia because the Swiss did it first and it worked for them. And Jefferson and the Founding Fathers knew that. That's what the Second Amendment is. The Second Amendment is not about duck hunting.
Very commonly people misconstrued. And why have we had such a hard time in Afghanistan, in Iraq? Why do we have such a hard time in Vietnam?
Exactly.
Why is it no occupying power has ever defeated an insurgency except the Chinese? Reason being, everybody has guns. In all these countries, the rebels just distribute guns. The Chinese, the reason why they defeated the insurgency was because A, they were fighting Buddhists who were pacifists, and B, because they killed 50% of the population in the most brutal, unimaginable way possible. Yeah. So that tends to quell resistance.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN, and we're talking about a whole range of solutions, specific solutions to America's problems today, both domestic and foreign policy. And if you'd like to join in with your idea or criticism or comment on the ideas that we're raising, give us a ring at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756, or drop us an email at ken@mdrtalk.org.
Okay, and then so the last caller did also mention something else that I want to go back to what our original point is. He was talking about how much money the Department of Defense actually consumes. And here's something that people don't consider. On a daily basis, the Department of Defense and its various uses consumes 360,000 barrels of oil a day. A day. Running Humvees and tanks and jets and aircraft carriers and just moving them around the globe. For no reason, really, just to aggressively posture. And that raises the cost of gasoline here. So you have to think about the implications before you take an aggressive stance on something. Can we afford to actually withstand the rising cost here at home? Because we're already suffering.
What is it doing to our economy? And, of course, there's a connection, because if we could take that money.
Tax money.
Take that money that's being used for the defense in these foreign wars and start investing them in infrastructure in this country to create decent-paying jobs, a more competitive economy.
Now, specifically, instead of using that money for something that is a consumable, all right? Now, war is a consumable. It's actually just blowing things up. Yeah. It doesn't create a thing, right?
Right.
So you're spending tax money, but it's a giveaway. It's not a production, right? So what would be a production that people would want? All right. Now, that would be something like magnetic levitation trains going across the country, a brand new reinvigoration of our technological know-how and our ability to create. We have a phone call?
We do. This is Pat from New Haven. Go ahead, Pat. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Pat. Thanks for being on the air.
I just want to compliment you on your show. Talk about a lot of topics that are of great interest to me. Usually when I tune into PKN, they got some left-wing drivel on there that I can't take for 5 minutes, but you guys are really talking about some issues I don't really think are left or right.
Right.
We agree completely.
This is populism.
Yeah, well, I think the country's, like, by design is divided into right and left, or just say two camps, and we're forced to, like, vote for two people which are basically on the same team against us. I mean, I believe the whole structure has been corrupted, where Obama, Bush, I mean, it seems like they're on opposite sides of the poll, but they're really exactly on the same side working against us, and it's all by design. That's, you know, what my take on it. After, you know, going through one election cycle after another, I've pretty much given up that there'll ever be anything.
Yeah, we're suggesting we need a second party in this country.
Well, it's a hard thing first of all, the population's so dumbed down that it would be pretty hard to do. Not that I'm saying.
Caller, do you have a candidate that you like?
What's that?
Do you have a candidate that you like that may be running?
I would vote for the janitor at a public school somewhere. I would think he'd have more common sense how to run the country than all these bought and paid for whores that we seem to keep having, you know.
All right. Thank you very much for the call.
Thanks a lot, Pat.
All right. So anyway, I was talking about maglev, and I did some research on this yesterday. Magnetic levitation trains for a 400-mile trip on an Amtrak diesel train takes 7 hours and 5 minutes.
Now, this is from where to where?
A 400-mile trip.
400 miles. So that'd be like Boston to Washington. Something like that. Yeah.
All right. A maglev train would take 2 hours and 54 minutes. And it could achieve a speed of 360 miles an hour. Wow. That's the current record holder, is a Chinese train.
Now, what do you say to the problem that we don't have the track space? You can't get
it's
the
not even
away.
That. I mean, it's just merely getting the funding. It's just getting it going. You know, we could right
so
now.
You just take, existing right away? Or
No, you'd have to rip up the rails and put something new. So in the Eastern Corridor, where it's just jam-packed, it would be much more complicated to achieve this. But the thing is that instead of just saying, oh, it's too hard, let's not do it, let's take American ingenuity and actually come up with a way to feasibly pull it off, right? So let's hire American engineers, steel makers. Let's get these trains built here. Americans filed patents for these in the 50s for maglev. It's the 50s, all right? And we're still running old steel wheel diesel trains that can't even take a corner at more than 50 miles an hour.
It's got to be a priority.
It's got
to
be.
As opposed to conquering Afghanistan
or
Iraq or Libya or Syria.
We have an aging infrastructure here that can't even get us from point A to point B without sitting in traffic. So why can't we come up with new ways to do things instead of just saying, oh, we have to tear it all down, and then what will we do for the 5 years it'll take to rebuild it?
We've got a can-do spirit.
Let's do it.
In this country, infrastructure development, especially led by the government, has been the basis for economic growth in this country since its foundation. You look at the Transcontinental Railroad, the Erie Canal, or more recently the interstate highway system, championed usually by Republicans, which is ironic, and since they're often said to be opponents of big government. It was Eisenhower, it was Lincoln that put these things forward.
And like, look at places like New York City, where they built a lot of highways because of congestion problems. How did they solve it? They made the highways elevated, right?
Right.
Or they make tunnels. So why can't we develop elevated or tunneled highway systems that can take over for the existing highways? Then once those are in place, we can tear down what's there, get it out of the way, reduce the congestion of concrete that's all over the place, and reuse that space
and
for something else.
This is going to create high-paying jobs, and when you're done with it, it's going to contribute to the
people
productivity,
will use it.
To the
people
standard
will,
of living.
You'll have productivity increase because people will be able to commute from further distances, so you'll have the effect of a metropolitan area be less congested inside it, but people will be able to live further away because they'll be able to get from Albany to New York City in only an hour.
The Erie Canal created – that's why New York is the Empire State, because the Erie Canal opened the goods to the West, to the raw materials to be brought down the Hudson to New York City.
So you increase the prosperity of those outlying areas.
Everybody wins, and that was a project that was a government-initiated. We could do a public-private. It doesn't matter as long as it gets done.
Right, and by comparison, I wrote down an airplane, even with a one-hour check-in – takes 2 hours and 20 minutes for that same 4 hour trip. So maglev would take 2 hours and 54 minutes. But with planes, you never know what's going to happen.
And with our new foreign policy, when it gets adopted, we're not going to have all these airport check-ins and taking off your clothes and your shoes or whatever,
and
all this other nonsense.
And on that note, if I may be so bold as to say, the TSA, so the TSA is patting people down, and feeling up children and,
people.
And making old people get up and examine their colostomy bags and putting their hands down your pants and all the rest of it. And you're telling me that this is why terrorists haven't bombed us. Yet there's a crowded room in the waiting area for the airport where nobody's checked for bombs. Now, unless we're dealing with mentally retarded terrorists, looking at, other terrorist organizations from FARC, the Irish Republican Army, the People's Liberation Army of Nepal, the Maoists of India, so on and so forth, I go on and on and on. None of them were so dumb as to try to get through airport checkpoints. They got the people when they were waiting outside the bloody airport. So clearly, this is all asinine behavior. It's a charade.
Let me just give out the phone number again, and then I'd like to raise another subject we haven't talked about yet. 203-336-9756. Call in and give us your thoughts on any issue, domestic, foreign. We're just searching around for solutions. If you have a new idea, great. If you want to comment on something we've talked about, that's great too.
If you want to tell us we're all full of malarkey,
that's fine.
Go right ahead.
We talked briefly about healthcare, and that is so complicated. We probably should do a whole show, at least one show on that. But an area we haven't talked about yet is education.
Yeah,
we are spending so much more money in this country than we used to. It seems like we spend more and we get more, and then we get less and less. And we're told the answer is to spend more.
The more money you spend, the less you get in return. I mean, exactly. Like, the job training system in this country is pitiful. We have a very poorly trained workforce, and a lot of companies who want to develop here can't, because our high schools don't do a good enough job at teaching kids how to just be just the basic job skills. And I think that we need to emulate something like the German model for high school, which has job training for high school students, so that they go and they spend a time at a company actually learning some kind of manufacturing skill, so they at least understand what's
right.
Entailed.
Instead of coming out of high school or even college and saying, okay, I've got, I've spent all these years and spent all this money, my parents.
But I don't even know how to speak to somebody.
You're right.
At a professional
level. It's not the student's fault. He's never been exposed.
Well, I mean, I think responsibility does fall on the individual.
But we've got this system which says to succeed, you've got to get this X, you jump through all these hoops, and at the end of it, you don't have anything that's useful.
I mean, today, who succeeds? It's the people who do take the personal liberty to go and expand their job skill listing, Those are the people who succeed right now. But we have to at least give people the the ability to find out if they don't know where to look for it.
All right, we have a couple of callers. First one is Jay from Bridgeport. Go ahead, Jay. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Jay. Thanks for calling.
I was just calling in because I heard something about, I want to know where this guy got the reference of Tibet having half its population killed off by the communist occupation, because I've never heard of this, and I'm just really curious where he gets his facts from.
It's a lot of it is from groups like Amnesty International, and it's a very obscured fact because we have very important trade relations with the Chinese. But the Chinese, when they invaded Tibet in 1951, they invaded Tibet, and the war crimes that they committed went largely unreported until eyewitnesses came back and started reporting it to eventually organizations like Amnesty International.
The only source of information is the Chinese army, and what are they going to say?
They didn't say anything, but it's become a known fact through a lot of – also the United Nations Human Rights Organization, that the Chinese, when they invaded Tibet – perpetrate mass executions, forcing children to shoot their parents. That was also very common. They'd put a gun in the hands of a Tibetan child and force him to shoot his parents.
That's what the Cambodians did.
Exactly. The Cambodians, well, they learned it from the Chinese. And then, the raping of nuns and, mass execution of monks, the destruction of many, many of the Buddhist temples, and in fact, the destruction of the ancient Tibetan capital of Lhasa.
Like I said, I took a quick look on Wikipedia. I don't see any of that documented to the level that you say versus Cambodia, which is well documented there.
Cambodia is well documented because, once the Khmer Rouge collapsed, all of this information came out in mass. Especially the reports of the genocide and whatnot. But a lot of it has been covered up. And our government's just as complicit in covering it up because we don't want to anger the Chinese. But if you go onto even Google and you look up Chinese war crimes in Tibet or mass murder in Tibet or just murder in Tibet, you'll find numerous articles of the genocide taking place in Tibet.
And Jay, if I could say that the Chinese have a lot of payback against the West, particularly the United States, because of the Opium Wars. We helped the British forced the Chinese in the early 19th century to allow the importation of opium, and it devastated the country for a century. And those guys don't forget, and they really got a grudge that, well, it's a grudge that that's well earned by the United States and Britain. So, but I don't think the thrust of caller of our comments is to alarm people about an imminent Chinese invasion. It's mere to redirect our attention that we shouldn't be devoting our resources towards world hegemony. We should be focusing on the defense of the territory of the United States.
I did just find one source online, and under Mao's regime, which in total killed about 40 million people, the agency France Presse in 1999, citing at length from Courtois, Stéphane, La Livre Neuve de Communisme. I'm not very good at
Tibetan
French.
Names are complicated.
All right, so the in Tibet it says that they killed between 0.6 and 1.2 million people.
Which,
so
for a country that size, they have a very small population.
It's a very wide range.
Have another
estimate.
Caller?
I'm afraid we have to go to another call.
Call, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jay.
Thank you.
All right, and this is Jim from Stratford. Go ahead, Jim. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Jim.
Hello, Jim.
Jim, are you there? Oh, it sounds like we lost Jim. Was there another call?
Yes, this is George from New Haven. Go ahead,
Jim.
Jim,
give us a ring back, Jim, and we'll get you on.
Yes, good afternoon.
This is George.
I was just listening to probably 20 minutes of the broadcast with the guests and the call-ins on the various topics regarding the U.S. Military capacity. And when I hear your guests and people, you know, I suppose they're experts in what they say. I don't know, but the United States military has the most awesome defensive offensive nuclear weapons delivery system on the planet. All of those nuclear armed submarines are all over the planet underneath the water outside various countries' borders and various continents. So I want to know, how is it that anyone can sit and say there's a possibility of foreigners invading the United States militarily or otherwise? And I'll just listen for some reason.
Okay, thanks very much for your call, George. I don't know if we just have about 6 minutes left in the show. I don't know
the outside.
And that's a really important question. We touched on it early in the show.
We may actually, you know, we may reserve that for next week when we do the war report.
Okay, okay, George.
Why don't we just say quickly right now and promise to listen in next week? But quickly right now, we're not saying necessarily that that is a direct threat of a manned invasion of the United States, but that we are unprepared to know who's outside our border, and with such a short window of warning. Between an EMP or a nuclear missile launch into our border from the near Atlantic or Pacific coast, we would be caught with our pants down, unable to respond, and being able to give advance warning to our forward
bases.
But
George, we will look
world.
Into that next week in our war report.
The fact is that in a nutshell, you never want to leave yourself vulnerable.
Yeah, I mean why invite the attack? You know?
Exactly. We have another caller. This is Bob from Long Island. Go ahead, Bob. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, in the 60s, I was obsessed with maglevs and turned the LaRouche organization onto them by accident. And me and a friend tried to build one. And I just wanted to mention, I was actually obsessing about them yesterday morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing some research. But I came up with a great idea for the New York area, that they have a maglev loop from LaGuardia Airport to Stewart Air Force Base and into Manhattan and shut down LaGuardia because it is a very dangerous airport and it's sort of absurd. And a maglev there in minutes and change the whole transportation structure of New York and introduce the United States.
This is a great idea.
This is what we're trying to invite. We don't want to start this endless debate of whether we're going to get invaded by the Chinese. That was just a minor issue. But we want these ideas of how we can reinvigorate our industrial standards in this country to get improved infrastructure.
Go to Albany and bring in those people people need an international airport upstate.
Exactly. Why can't we go from Boston to Austin, Texas? You know, on one loop going down the southern seaboard, or one from Washington, D.C. to St. Louis, or Seattle to San Diego.
And these become possible.
Blair is Commissioner of Sanitation in Chapel Hill. He's been working for years to try to get the high-speed, the Excella extended down through North Carolina.
Well, we thank you very much for the call.
Thank you so much, Bob.
And we're going to jump.
Also, are you guys aware of the Chinese evacuated tube maglevs that can do thousands of miles an hour?
That I have not heard of. That sounds pretty cool.
I was helped by an American engineer in New Mexico, and they hired him and brought him over there.
See? It's the Chinese who are forward-thinking right now.
So we need to catch up here. Thanks so much for your call, Bob.
Thank you very much. Go ahead. This is Mike from Bridgeport. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air with the
WPKN. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I am increasingly concerned about the privatization of national security. What are your thoughts?
Yes, that is an incredible concern because you end up not only overpaying for it, it becomes something that is an endless black hole of money and resources. So when we had the war in Iraq, Halliburton made many, many millions of dollars, and companies like Blackwater, now called Z, end up making millions of dollars just for being there.
Washington posted an excellent expose of this about a year ago. I don't know if you saw that, Mike, but it was about the tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of jobs who are now being enjoyed by private contractors in the burgeoning intelligence field.
What are they doing? Just spying on each other?
It doesn't matter. They're washing laundry.
Nobody really knows because part of the in that study, the Washington Post had a quote from the top general in the intelligence apparatus who said he'd received no useful intelligence from any of his companies.
See, they're just justifying their own existence by maybe they even blow something up and then they predict it, you know? So just so it looks like they actually are on top of something. But like Halliburton will run empty trucks across the country to get hazard pay when they're not even doing anything useful.
We really need to dismantle this whole national security apparatus.
I mean, the fact is that, you know, the Department of the Army, the Department of the Navy, Department of the Air Force, and, you know, can all do what Halliburton is doing and more efficiently.
And that's what President Kennedy wanted to do when he wanted to take the operative power away from the CIA and return it to the armed services.
But again, do you want to mention any more ideas on how to reinvigorate our country? Because I feel like we keep getting pulled.
Get back
to
national security.
Thing.
I really think.
But thank you very much for your call.
Thank you very much, Mike. I think education is really important. I think a theme that I want to leave people with is the idea of decentralization of power, economic and political power in this country, to the family and to the local community. And say in education, I think we should encourage home-based education. Mm-hmm. I know in my community in Fairfield County, there's a provision. Our school board has a provision which allows students to go part-time to school. Nobody in my community knows about it, but it's on the books.
And the school doesn't even like it.
The school doesn't like it because they get worried they're going to lose jobs, they're going to lose budget. But I think we have to be more creative. I think we have to be more cost-effective. And I think, why not? If a child wants to go to school just to learn, say, math or foreign languages or lab science and spend the rest of his time at home, fine. It'll save everybody money. He'll probably end up with just as good or maybe a better education because he'll be pursuing at home on his own schedule the things that are of interest.
And everybody has to keep in mind that everyone likes to have publicly funded, available institutions. But when you have things, when everything is paid for by tax money, it's a basic rule of economics that money has to... It's going someplace, and then it's either coming back to the economy or it's being spent and wasted. So the government, if you're spending tax money to the government, they are taking that money, spending it on something, and a percentage of that is coming back into the economy via pay for teachers. But a lot of that money is overpaid and therefore wasted. So it sends the whole system out of proportion. Now all of a sudden you have money being sucked out of the economy, which is being underpaid in the private sector, to an overpaid public sector, and the money is disappearing. It's going out into the nothingness.
And we're all against fraud and waste, fraud and abuse, and it's everywhere. You look at the healthcare, wherever you see it. So I'm afraid we only have about 1 minute left. So any closing thoughts?
I thought we'd go out with Huey Long.
Okay, the great Huey Long. We'll go out with the great, and we will be on again next Monday at noon, and with our war report.
And find us on incontextreport.com. Find us on YouTube, youtube.com/incontextreport, and like us on Facebook. We'll see everybody next week.
Yes, Ken and Marshawn.
Republican Party was just like the old patent medicine drummer that used to come around our country. He had two bottles of medicine. He'd play a banjo and he'd sell two bottles of medicine. One of those bottles of medicine was called High Papa Laurel. And another one of those bottles of medicine was called Low Papa Howard. Finally, somebody around there said, is there any difference in these medicines? Oh, he said, considerable. They're both good, but they're different. He said that high popolorum is made from the bark off the tree that we take from the top down. And that low popohirum's made from the bark that we take from the root up. the only difference that I have found between the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership was that one of them was skinning from the ankle up and the other from the ear down when I got to Congress.